We spoke about what the Buddha called the three marks of existence, or the three characteristics. Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. Anicca means change, ceaseless change. Everything's always in flux. Everything is always in the process of becoming something else. You know, arising, changing, and passing away, which is essentially the kind of instruction that I gave at the beginning of our time meditating this evening, because that's what you do when you're doing one form of insight meditation practice, which is to simply sit and watch the flow of experience. Okay. The coming and going of thoughts and emotions and bodily sensations and smells and whatever else is going on, right? Sort of like if you were sitting at the bank of a stream watching bubbles go by, you know, or just various sort of objects and things that they come through the field of vision and they're there for a while and then they're gone. And it seems like, you know, that Zoe Burstein wrote that book, you know, one of the teachers in this tradition a few years ago, called It's Easier Than You Think, and she said, well, you know, my editor maybe, or my publisher liked that title. She said, I should have said it's simpler than you think. You know, it's not always easy, but it is astonishingly simple. It's learning the art of sitting patiently and with some degree of kindness and just watching what's going on in the mind. And we spoke a little bit about last week about why that is so important to be able to do. It seems simple and unadorned, which it is, but to the extent that you can watch the unpleasant arise, and watch ill will arise, or anger, or fear, or some other difficult emotion, and simply watch it arise and note its characteristics and note how it changes, and then note how it dissipates, how it becomes something else. Okay, the ability to do that in a non-reactive way is incredibly important. You know, that is really masterful mind training, because if you don't have that capability, then you react to whatever it is that comes along that you don't like. You try to push it away, or you reach out to seize whatever it is you do want. Okay, and so this training that we're undergoing is at its base about the cultivation of a deep state of equanimity. The Buddha, when he spoke about dukkha, you know, again, that which is unsatisfactory, that which is difficult to bear, you know, the etymology of it having to do with sand getting caught in the hub of a wheel on a cart and causing resistance. You know, I've used that analogy, I think, once when I was teaching out at the federal men's prison, and somebody says, yeah, I said, I got way too much sand in my gears, you know? So, you know, it's hard to ride your bike if you got sand in your gears, or if you got sand in the hub or whatever. There's more resistance, there's greater difficulty. And the more dukkha that you find you have in your life, the harder it is to bear, the harder it is to do the work of moving along. And so we can think about, you know, doing this practice is kind of like, you know, major maintenance on the psyche, kind of, right? Or going in there and seeing where the sand, where the grit is, you know, get way too much grit in my hubs. And just kind of washing it out, repacking it, cleaning it a little bit, you know. And noting with care what it is that arises, you know, that we would call difficult. So the Buddha said, you know, this sense of unsatisfactoriness, or things not being right, or they ought to be different than they are in some way or another. He said it's a universal phenomenon. And it's universal in that it applies in different ways to the different kinds of suffering or the different kinds of dissatisfaction that we all experience. Well, the Buddha said one of the reasons that we feel dissatisfaction, discomfort, is the mere fact that we're in a body, right? This body has needs. You know, you wake up in the morning, and even if it's, you're planning it to be a beautiful day where you do nothing but what you want to do, of course, you think you can just lie there and make all your choices, but the body has other ideas, right? Just, excuse me, I'd like to go to the bathroom now. And then, how about some breakfast, you know? Maybe put on some clothes, you know? So there are these needs that arise, whether we want to them to or not, and they create a little bit of discomfort or dissatisfaction, you know? So one source of discomfort's alleviated once you use the bathroom, and then you say, well, my mouth tastes kind of funky, so you brush your teeth. And so there's all these things that arise because there is some state of mild dissatisfaction that you need to address just in order to live. And that's just the day-to-day sort of discomforts that we deal to simply in order to live. By and large, we tend to take the experience of pain very personally, right? That if something hurts, it doesn't just hurt, it hurts us, right? And so there tends to be the state of aversion to our own nervous systems when they're sending us information that we don't particularly want to receive. But it's really worth stopping and thinking for a moment that the sense interpreting nervous system is one of the most crucial survival mechanisms in our DNA. If we didn't have that, if we didn't have the ability to experience pain, we wouldn't be here as a species, right? So even though it may feel uncomfortable, it's performing a really valuable function. And that's true whether it's physical pain or whether it's emotional pain, you know? That you're feeling the pain for a reason. If it's emotional pain, maybe because you're feeling loss, or you're feeling fear, or you're feeling anger, or irritated, or something like that. Or a feeling of longing, something that is not okay the way it is, but you feel like there ought to be doing something about it. So these different forms of dukkha based on, you know, different aspects of being in the world. Another way to think about it is the Buddha said, well, you know, another way to categorize dukkha is into two categories. One is dukkha in the presence of self, and the other is dukkha in the absence of self. Any idea which one hurts more? Well, it's what the Buddha called the second dart, of course, when you experience something that's unpleasant. If you respond to the unpleasantness from the perspective of self. Okay. And this is whether it is something physical that happens to you, something psychological that happens to you, something that somebody says. If it is taken in as any kind of direct threat, okay, then the tendency is to react from a place of self. Okay. From a place of revenge or vengeance or anger or fear, or some other difficult emotion that triggers a speech or action that causes suffering, because we've experienced the suffering from the place of self. And that also holds true for physical suffering, for physical ailments, you know, for injuries and illnesses and whatnot. There is this inevitable tendency. Why should that happen to me, you know? Why should I have to suffer what it is that I'm experiencing right now? Why was I picked out? Why was I chosen for this? Well, actually you weren't. It just sort of came along with being in the body, right? And are the whatever genetic hand we got dealt is playing itself out, you know? And there are things that we can do to try to take care of ourselves and stay well. But beyond that, we're just along for the ride, right? You know, it's like, Richard Baer, who a member of the Sangha, who's away on a retreat right now, he said his Korean Zen teacher, Son Sanim, used to speak about this body as a rental car. We have it for a little while, and you know, it may be run okay, but after a while, some of the parts get a little funky and need to get swapped out, except for the ones that can't be swapped out, and then, oh well, better luck next time around. But if we can sit with our experience of being in the world with that kind of dispassion, without taking quite that personally, then it can make all the difference in the world. That's why when you go on a retreat sometime, and this used to be a much stronger suggestion in the old days than it is now, which is to say, if you're sitting and you begin to feel discomfort, you know, our general tendency is to immediately react, change position, do something, you know, fear that maybe we're harming the body in some way. And so we used to be encouraged to experiment with, if we feel the unpleasant and you feel the urge to move, don't. Just spend a few moments sitting with the experience of the uncomfortable. Or if you have an unhappy thought, you know, instead of trying to think about something else, you may just sit with that which is uncomfortable. It's incredibly valuable mind training. You know, the ability to experience the unpleasant without aversion and the pleasant without attachment. You know, that's very close to the core of what the Buddha taught about being in the world. Because as you begin to do that gradually, little bit at a time, you begin to be able to experience the unpleasant without such a strong sense of self that's responding to it. The weaker the sense of self is, the weaker, or the less likelihood that there is that you're going to do something or say something unskillful out of your place of discomfort, out of your place of dissatisfaction. The Buddha, in describing dukkha in the presence of self, one of the similes he used, you know, he was living in an agrarian society during his time, and out in the countryside there would be these herdsmen, and they would have herds of cows, and they'd be in the barn or in the enclosure in the evenings, and then in the morning the herdsmen would take the herd out and take it out into the meadow, out into the fields to feed. And there was a lead cow that would take the troop, you know, get out in front and take the troop where they were going to go. And then the herdsman would walk along to one side. He had a great big long stick. And any of the cattle that hadn't quite got with the program, you know, if they decided they were going to stop and, you know, eat something along the way or sniff the flowers or whatever, the herdsman would walk along and whack them with a stick and get them back in with the herd and keep moving along. And he said, you know, the unawakened are like that herd of cows, drawn by their desires and driven by their fears, you know. They're drawn forth in the morning and they're drawn home in the evening, you know, until their last sunset. And so he's talking about awakening to a state where life consists of more than just being drawn by your desires and driven by your fears. And that is a lot of what we do when we do this practice, which is to simply examine, okay, what's drawing me? What's driving me? What am I having trouble with right now? You know, why is it that I'm experiencing the unpleasant in this way? When Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was one of the second generation Dharma bums, who went with Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Wes Nisker and Gravy and that whole crew to India to sit with some different teachers in 1970, when he came back and, you know, studied Buddha Dharma for a long time, and then he set up this this pain management clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center that went on to develop into what he called his mindfulness-based stress reduction program, which is kind of secular practice of mindfulness, basically. But this program of treatment that he came up with at the medical center was one which was designed to help people who were in chronic, unremitting, agonizing pain. Pain for which no medication was proving effective. Pain even for which surgery had not proven effective. And they were living in hell realms. They were experiencing, you know, intense bodily pain all the time. and nothing else was working for them. So what he did was to put together a training program, and it consisted of doing some guided relaxation work, doing some stretching, doing some gentle yoga, and doing mindfulness meditation. And in particular, he focused on the first foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body. And these are people who were experiencing ongoing extreme aversion to the pain in their bodies. And so what he trained folks to do in that program was to say, all right, let's contemplate the experience of your pain. What is the nature of your pain? Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it sharp? Is it dull? Is it rugged? Is it rough? Is it smooth? Is it constant? Is it intermittent? Okay, come up with as many different descriptors as he could for what people were physically experiencing, just the physical experience of the pain. And then what he had them do was to disaggregate the physical experience of the pain from the emotional component. Okay, let me see what's going on here. Usually shuts up after a minute. Sorry. And this is actually the same technique that, with variations, is used a lot with people who are working with post-traumatic stress. Which is to say, you disaggregate the physical experience. What is the sensation literally like? And just focus on that, just the facts of the matter, nothing else. And get to the point where you can distinguish the physical sensation from the emotional component. Because the emotional component, most of the time, with unremitting pain, and you want nothing so much in the world as for this pain to go away. Okay, your whole, all of your energy is devoted to aversion to that pain. If you can distinguish the physical component of it, the physical sensation, from the terror, okay, from the hopelessness, from the despair, this is the worst thing I've ever experienced in my life, and it's never going to go away, and I'll never be happy again, I'll never experience another pain-free moment in my life. You know, that thinking, you know, that despair, that hopelessness, that depression, that sense of just being beaten down into nothingness by the physical experience. There's something about the uncoupling of those two that seems to have been key to the success of that particular approach in helping people deal with or manage or live with pain that in their experience had become intolerable. And it had to do with nothing more than training the mind to be with dukkha in a different way, to start getting away from, oh, how horrible this pain is that I am experiencing. Why was I chosen to experience this in this way? It had the effect, to a substantial degree, of depersonalizing the experience of pain, of simply participating in the experience of pain by virtue of what was going on in their body at that time, of what was going on in the mind-body process. And having learned that lesson, they were able to develop a significantly different relationship with their pain. It didn't always necessarily go away. In fact, a lot of cases it didn't really change much at all in terms of, you know, how they would describe the, you know, the pain threshold or the pain intensity or whatnot. But the emotional component had changed a lot, because they had learned to deal with the aversion to the pain in a very different way. And they had kind of begun to take in the fact that the experience of this pain is a universal human phenomenon. Some of us experience more of it than others, depending on how things are in our lives right now. But the means by which we live our lives in the presence of that pain is what either wakes us up from being one of the cows in the herd or not. And so that's pretty close to the core of the Buddhist message about dukkha. It's not take it personally. It happens to everybody, okay? Whether it's the physical side or the emotional side or the rest of it, okay? But being with it in that open and honest and caring way has the potential for transforming your relationship to it, okay? So we're reacting to pain, okay? Not as a frightened person, but as a bodhisattva. We seek to alleviate our own pain just like we would anybody else's. So if there's skillful things that can be done, you know, in the realm of medical care or pain management or psychotherapy, if that's what's going on, we do it, but we don't do it with that lingering sense of aversion. You know, it's one of the reasons that a lot of people get disenchanted with Buddha Dharma, is because when the Buddha talks about being free of suffering, free of dukkha, they think that means making it go away. And it takes a long time for it to sink in that that's not really what he's talking about at all. You know, what he's talking about at all is revolutionizing our relationship to that which is difficult to bear. So, let's talk about that. Anything that I've said that may resonate, that you have a comment or a question about, please.
You said that they don't, as often now when doing insight meditation, they don't say things like, if you get uncomfortable, sit with it. Why don't they do that as much anymore?
When mostly this tradition has been brought to the West by Western teachers who sat with Asian teachers, some of whom were very stern, very disciplined, had very strict programs of study on their courses. So when they came back and started teaching, they were teaching pretty much as they had just been taught, which was pretty hardcore. So 14 hours a day of sitting and walking practice in silence. And one of the teachers, Goenkaji, he used to invite people to experiment. They didn't have to, but he invited them to experiment with what he called vow hours. And a vow hour is one in which you would sit and vow not to move an inch for that hour. Except his vow hours tend to be about 3 hours long. So a lot of long faces after a sit like that, but for those, and of course, Ajahn Amaro, and one of my teachers, talked about, you know, it's what's called dharma pain, and there's actual physical pain. You know, if you're sitting there as you're feeling your meniscus gradually being rent asunder, you know, not so good, not so skillful. You know? He said, you know, if you feel pain while you're sitting, and then it may either go away, or if it doesn't, he said, when the sit's over and you stretch and relax and get up to move about, he said, if you find the pain dissipates, then chances are it was something that was just trying to get your attention away from doing the practice. And to the extent that you're able to just be with the uncomfortable without reaction, okay, that it's powerful training in the realm of equanimity. And you never know when it may come in handy. I have two favorite stories in that regard from two different members of the Sangha. One was a bunch of years ago up in the high country skiing, out of bounds, of course, smacks into a tree, horrible twisting compound fracture of her leg, white light agony, the like of which she'd never experienced in her life, including in childbirth. And the people found her and whatnot, but it was going to take the ski patrol a while to get there because she was out in the boonies. And she was just lying there, and she said the agony was unspeakable. She was really afraid she was going into shock. In addition to the physical pain, she was panicked. She was terrified that she'd crippled herself, you know, or that she'd done horrible permanent nerve damage, and she was always going to be suffering this kind of pain. And then she was just lying there. She says, "Well, maybe I should try meditating. Nothing else to do, you know." And so she just started, you know, mindfulness and the body stuff, characterizing the pain and what was going on. And then, well, here comes terror, you know, and she watched the terror arise and change and pass away. And then she felt another bolt of pain. And then she, you know, started her catastrophizing thinking again, right? But things were loosening up a little. You know, it's like Soaking Rinpoche when he talks like beads on a mala, like that, you know, that if they're tight together, it looks like one solid thing. But what happens when we're doing this practice is that we're gradually loosening the string. So that there's a little bit of space between the physical sensation and the thought that comes after. And so she found the practice that she learned here really effective. Another member of the Sangha got a phone call that her young son had been in a terrible accident and was critically injured. And it's the hospital where he was at, so she rushed to the emergency room. He was in surgery, and they could tell her nothing more than that. So they weren't gonna know how bad it was until they got in there, and they shared information with her as soon as they had it. And so she was sitting alone, as it turns out, there weren't any relatives, other relatives there yet. With that, you know, with this absolute terror in her heart as to whether her son was going to live, and if so, what kind of condition he was going to be in. And again, she was going out of her mind with grief and fear, and yet at some point, nothing else to do. So she starts to meditate. And can name the terror, and can name the fear, can name the catastrophizing thoughts, breathe. You know, things open up, loosen up just a little bit. So what had been this almost unbearable emotional experience becomes something that can be managed. Okay. Simply by virtue of slightly renegotiating the relationship to dukkha. Just being with it in that somewhat different way, to the extent possible. You know, because both the women telling these stories said it was really helpful, and then every once in a while the whole thing would just collapse, you know, and the agony and the terror and all would just coalesce again, you know, into the big green-eyed monster. And then, you know, I would gradually remember, whether it was noting the breathing or whatever, that suddenly it became possible to open up and get regrounded a little bit. You know, so it's not like flipping the switch, you just kind of go from one to the other. It's almost in some ways kind of like a continuum from being just engrossed in the selfhood associated with the difficult to being at a point where you can see that it's got you, but you can see, you know, there's an awakening to the process. And then sometimes the awakening can take you to the point where you can be with some pretty tough stuff, but be with it in a way that it doesn't gobble you up. You know, there's this book by a physician who spends time with people who are facing chronic, sometimes life-threatening illnesses. And she was talking about a book she'd read about bullfighting. In bullfighting lore in Spain, there's this idea, this concept called the cadencia. And the cadencia is a place of refuge in the wild, for wildlife. And see, all animals have this, have their place, you know, the place where the wild things go, you know. And so in bullfighting, the matador's job is to figure out where the bull's cadencia, where his place of safety is in the bull ring, and try to keep him away from it. So he'll be off balance and always wanting to fight, because once the bull finds the safe spot, the cadencia, he won't fight anymore. And it'll feel boring and they have to haul him off instead of killing him. So she says that, in her view, everybody has their own cadencia. They have their own refuge, their own inner refuge someplace. You know, that, and we get there by different means, and the Dharma is one means of getting, of discovering where your cadencia is and going there, being there. So if that place can be found, and it can be found, that's why we call it practice. when we do this practice, especially if we're doing it in a difficult time, you know, if there's some stress or whatever, partly what we're doing is we're rediscovering, we're rewalking, kind of like that labyrinth out there. We're walking our way, tracing our way back to the place of safety, the place of internal refuge, you know. And sometimes you're like ridicule, like, you know, go to your safe place or whatever, if you're frightened or in pain or whatever, but it's for real, you know. To the extent that we can really calm things down, energize the parasympathetic nervous system, allow that calming influence to take over the thought process, relax what's going on, a lot of things become possible with regard to one's relationship to the difficult than might otherwise be the case. So, yeah, please.
Hi, I've had minor scoliosis since, I don't know when it started, probably the early 90s, and I never knew what to do with it.
What was it, the problem?
Minor scoliosis, like shoulder pain.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. So, I've been doing as you've been talking about, except for the, well, one thing I want to mention is I used to say to myself, my back is hurting me.
Yes.
And I realized how personal I was taking it.
Right.
And over the years, I've developed a system that you were talking about as far as yoga and which school yoga was good for me.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, relaxation, yoga nidra, body relaxation, working on my posture when I read. A lot of it was hunched over reading in my daily reading.
Yes.
And really contributing to the pain. And then yoga, meditation, body relaxation. Oh, meditation, I've been performing daily meditation for, I don't know, probably a year, and doing yoga for 2.5. And the only thing I was missing was the naming and not taking it so personally, uh-huh, uh-huh, just seeing it physically as it is.
Yeah.
And so thank you for that. I really
sure,
appreciate that.
Sure, of course, yeah. If any of you have had physical therapy, I just went through a course, I blew out our rotator cuff, but one of the things that, in working with a therapist, he was talking, I kept wanting to know, okay, what did I do to make this happen, you know, so I could not do it in the future or whatever, and it was a way of personalizing it, you know, I should have been more mindful or what was going on that I should have done differently so I wasn't experiencing this pain. And gradually, you know, this fellow was working with me. He said, you know, it was basically turned into kind of a Dharma talk. He said, it's just kind of the nature of being in a body. That, you know, if you're heavily right dominant, for instance, you know, you just wear down some parts of your body before others. But for somebody like a body worker, physical therapist, or massage therapist, they've seen it all. And a part of the skill of that kind of work, basically, you know, is to say, not, well, this is what's going on just in your shoulder. It was more like, this is the nature of the shoulder. You know, these are the kinds of connective tissues. These are the, you know, these are the bones. These are the tendons. You know, speaking in a more impersonal way, and just kind of reacquainting me with the body. In a way where I'm not blaming myself for, you know, whatever it was that happened, or also not blaming myself if the therapy doesn't turn out to be as effective as it might be or whatever, you know, but just recognizing that it is sort of a universal condition that we face, and that to the extent we can just acknowledge that and just say, yep, here we are, we're all basically in this together, and so this is, you know, what managed to happen to me this time around, but it's not that different than what happens to anybody else. Yeah.
And it also helps with the healing. So having that, not taking it personally, and separating that, your body will heal.
Interesting. Yeah. Have you seen some data on that or something?
No, it's from...
But your experience, your personal experience. Sure, of course.
In my practice, and it really, it helps with just being present with the injury and not fighting.
Yes, exactly, the aversion.
You know what,
yeah,
your body really wants to heal, and then you can respond and say, well, I've got to do this movement better or something, and
Yes. My sister is a massage therapist, actually, and when she's working on somebody, whether it's a recent trauma or something that happened a great long while ago, or a surgery, and she's, you know, working in an area around a surgical scar or something like that, she said that obviously what begins to happen as she's working on the tissues is that there's a huge, a lot of stuff going on in the person they're working on. Because what it's doing is triggering all these memories. You know, memories of the trauma or memories of the surgery or whatever that the body remembers. You know, it doesn't particularly want to have that happen again. And so it remembers very carefully, and the memories are awakened through touch. And she said a fair amount of time there'll be people experiencing fear or grief or something like that associated with the experience that led to that discomfort in the body. And that, again, if they can simply acknowledge that that's what's going on rather than just asking her to stop, it tends to have a powerful cathartic effect. It's as if she's releasing not just the tension in the muscle, but the fear in the mind that created the tension in the muscle in the first place. And so, yeah, given the body a chance to do so, especially, you know, working with someone with those kind of skills, it fundamentally shifts the relationship to suffering and makes it easier for us to take it in just as more some aspect of the universal human experience, you know, rather than something that happened to poor me. There's an Ojibwe saying, I go about lost in self-pity at times, yet all the while a wind is moving me across a great sky. Yeah, it's just please.
Hi. The concept of dukkha, I think, is very relevant to my life. It's part of the reason what's drawn me to this practice.
Yes. Yes.
And so after I graduated from college, just all of a sudden I had just this big question, which I had never anticipated, which is like, now what? Just very existential type questions and anxiety that I had never, expected that these questions would dawn on me. And so, you know, there's anxiety, there's depression. And,
yes.
And I've also been through periods of unemployment because I've not through my fault of my own, I've gotten laid off or something. And so during that hardship of looking for the next job it's not a fun experience.
No, not at least.
So, you know, there's a sense of hopelessness and definitely depression. And,
yes.
Do you have any insight about those kind of hardships in life or how that relates to the concept of dukkha?
Yes, thank you very much. Beautiful question. First, one of the things that struck me, just like sometimes we can tend to feel guilty about pain that we have, you know, like, oh, if I'd been taking better care of myself, I wouldn't have got this illness or whatever. The same thing really struck me during the times in my life when I've been involuntarily unemployed, which is that our culture has this narrative that if you don't have a job, it's your fault. You know, that rather than it being structural stuff having to do with the economy, and the kinds of dislocations that it creates all the time, that somehow or another, if you lose your job, it's because you weren't good enough, you know, or because you should have been doing it differently, you should have been working harder, you should have been kissing up to the boss or whatever, you know, and the fact that you find yourself in this situation, there is this, and it's a pretty strong, you know, cultural narrative, you know, that to take it on yourself rather than have a look at the bigger picture and say, what structure is going on here that's causing this to happen? With specific regard to the mental states that you were talking about, the Buddha had actually, I don't want to say he had an app for that, he had a name for it, it's called Samvega, and it's sometimes called, translated as urgency, and sometimes as anxiety. And what he was referring to in that teaching is that this, and you know, you might need to call it even like existential angst, you know, that the questions of purpose and meaning and the difficulty one's facing, he said that is a very real phenomenon. It's a very real state of mind that arises. And he says, as difficult as it can be to experience that state of mind, he said that the sense of urgency is actually a fuel. He said, because what it does is it urges the mind to inquire carefully into the nature of one's own existence and to come up with questions like, why is there suffering? You know, why am I feeling this anxiety? What's going on here? And he essentially was saying that those kinds of questions or feelings are actually programmed into the human mind. You know, that when people ask, well, what's the purpose or meaning of life? You know, and one answer to that is, the purpose and meaning of life is to ask yourself, what is the purpose and meaning of life? That it's not as if there's one answer, you know, carved in gold across a heavenly gate. You know, what it is the invitation for us to go forth and look within. And so the teaching the Buddha gave was samvega on one hand and pasada on the other. Pasada means confidence or sense of grounding. And he said what happens when you realize what's going on with the samvega or the anxiety, he talked about it classically in karmic terms, the kinds of things that people are fearful of loss of nutriment, that is literally not being able to make a living and take care of oneself and whatnot. Loss of one of the thing, or another thing in terms of karma, fear of the future consequences of past actions, fear of the future consequences of future actions. What if I blow it, you know, and I'm going to experience bad karma in the past? Fear of loss, you know. And he said these things, you know, they're programmed into the human mind. And we, by and large, choose not to acknowledge that they were there. But when something happens, like losing a job or having some difficulty arise in one's life or breaking up in a relationship or death of a loved one or something like that, that suddenly the emotional impact of that experience just busts things wide open. And you find yourself asking about all this stuff at once and what's going on. And the way he described it, that's like an egg breaking open so the chicken can get out. It's a stage of growth. It's a stage of development. And that rather than simply turn to one side or try to numb yourself, you know, with whatever's out there, that instead to, you know, like James Baldwin said, when some, you know, Cyril Rice there was getting his life threatened all the time and whatnot. I say, how do you deal with this living under this constant sense of threat and people hating you and whatnot? He said, one of the things I learned was that whatever it is in life that scares you, move toward it. Mm-hmm. Move toward it. Mm-hmm. So that it doesn't control you, your fear doesn't control you, you know. And so the Buddha's advising with regards to samvega, go forth, explore these things that are troubling to you, that frighten you, that upset you, you know. The fears that you have, they're quite reasonable. You know, they come along with being a human being in this body, in this world, needing to look after ourselves and seeing this not, the social order isn't always organized in such a way as to help us take care of each other. And sometimes it feels like just the opposite. And so how do we learn how to take care of ourselves spiritually in partnership with others who have the same motivation? And that's where sanghas come from. You know, we all, in one way or another, have to some extent or another experienced exactly what you're talking about. And that's what brought a lot of us to Buddha Dharma. So it has a useful purpose. It's just difficult when it's going on. Yeah, thank you. Wonderful question. Please.
Thinking about applying this to modern day times and problems that I think a lot of people are having with just bombardment by distractions and trying to be focused in this sort of media saturated, information saturated, information overload kind of world we're living in. How would you, you know, apply that?
Right.
Teaching to this. Just being able to get out of the swirl of the overstim to take a moment.
Yeah, I've been, since retiring, whenever possible, I've been taking the opportunity to go on retreats. One of the things I like about being on retreat is that it's 100% news fast.
Yes.
You know, there is no news at all from any source, right? And it's wonderfully freeing, you know. It was, you know, the Buddha said, he said, you become what you think. And if what we think is mostly informed by what we read or what we see in the news media or whatnot, then we're in a world of hurt, you know?
Just driving down the street and just all of the signage and lights and, I mean, yeah.
Right. There are, you know, it's an important skill. And we, in our minds, it's, you know, we make these decisions, I think, probably thousands and thousands of times a day without knowing it. You know, what sensory inputs are important to pay attention to and organize into some form that helps me, you know, avoid harm and you know, meet basic needs, and which ones are really kind of irrelevant, you know. If the mind didn't have the ability to do that, it would be total chaos. That's just working on the day-to-day, getting from here to there kind of thing, what to buy at the supermarket. When we take it to the level of social interaction and governance and whatnot, it really can begin to feel like it's completely overwhelming. So for me, what I used to listen to NPR every morning as I was, you know, making breakfast or whatever, not so much anymore. It's as if I was going to hear something in the news that morning that was I was going to be able to do something about, right? And I don't devour the papers in quite the way that I used to either. It's not that I don't care, and it's not that I'm trying to just close myself off from the world. I think that it's very much like, very akin to having a wise and healthy diet in terms of what we consume physically.
Yes.
I think it's worth paying enormous attention to what we allow into our consciousness in terms of what we read or listen to. I think disengaging, because, you know, the way, and I've had like students and some of my graduate students in some of my classes who used to work for news organizations editing the news. And they said the whole purpose of editing the news is to instill fear. Because what they're trying to do is to stimulate the survival need, you know, threaten the survival need in the Maslowian needs hierarchy, to create an urgency on the part of the reader to read whatever story they've written, you know, which is always cast in some way as to pose a potential threat to you or your well-being or democracy or our environment, which is not to say those threats don't exist, but the whole thrust of the news narrative, you know, is threat, is to create anxiety and thus create an appetite for or a need to read their story to see if your fears can be assuaged, which they won't be. But that's the strategy. And so that's one of the reasons that it can be unhealthy to do that, you know, which is not to say don't pay attention to the news, but maybe in somewhat more measured ways and in somewhat smaller doses. Spending more time out of doors when the weather allows, finding some way to be connected to nature, you know, on a daily basis, even if it's just walking around the block or whatever, some way that, you know, that kind of revitalizes our connection to the living earth, you know. I find my membership in the Sangha to be enormously helpful in that regard. You know, I think we're here focused on the wholesome, you know, on how to speak, how to interact with each other, how to be in the world together in a way that makes positive change. And there are actually millions of people in this country and elsewhere who feel the same way, and are doing the same stuff. We just don't make above the full page one news. So we have to seek it out ourselves. And Don gobbled up another two perfectly good hours. So let's take just a moment to settle back into our sitting posture. And allow the eyes to gently close. The attention to come to rest on the breathing. May we all live with ease and know ease of well-being. May we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we be open to the joy that lies within us and be happy. May we share that happiness with others around us and theirs with us. May we rest in silence and stillness, at peace with things as they are. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart. May we awaken and be free. Thanks, everybody. I'm off on retreat. Sitting with my good buddy Joseph. I'll see you all about 3 weeks from now.